From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in May of last year, when locally the Black Agenda Group declared racism a public health crisis. That declaration came 2 months after the COVID-19 crisis had already started changing America. Action for a Better Community is now asking what we can do about both crises. And it will host an upcoming conference where CEO Jerome Underwood says the goal is to be disruptive and forceful in demanding change to policies, practices, and systems that are inherently racist or result in disproportionate outcomes. The conference is called Racism is a Public Health Crisis, Attacking the Two Pandemics, and it will address how to heal communities and economies during this time of uncertainty and disparities. We preview the conference this hour with our guests, and I will introduce them now. Jerome Underwood is the president and CEO of Action for a Better Community and member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group. Jerome, welcome back to the program.
Good afternoon, Devin, and good afternoon to the WXXI listening public and my fellow panelists.
You got to do it over the phone still. Wish we were all together in person.
I know.
Soon enough, my friend. Melanie Funchess, member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group and the Black Healers Network. Melanie, welcome back to the program.
Welcome. Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Simeon Bannister, Vice President of Community Programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation and a member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group. Simeon, welcome back to you.
Same, Evan. Good to be back.
And Matthew Kuhlenbeck is President and CEO of the Greater Rochester Health Foundation. Matthew, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to talk all about what you've got planned coming up here as we talk about racism as a public health crisis. But I would be remiss if I didn't ask all of you just to weigh in, if you could, on a subject that a number of our listeners have asked me to ask you about. Not the least of which is member of the New York State Assembly, Sarah Clark, who was on this program last Thursday talking about her reaction, having served several United States senators, of having seen the events of Wednesday in the Capitol, the riot and the insurrection. She followed up with me separately and she said, I'm so glad you're going to have Jerome and the group on, because it shook her seeing how gently the rioters were treated vis-a-vis some of the images we've seen in different demonstrations across the country for months now. Jerome, I'm going to start with you. What strikes you about what you saw last Wednesday and maybe how different that looked compared to so many other scenes?
Evan, I wasn't surprised. I guess I would say it's evidence number 842 that racism is a public health crisis. I, you know, like many others, tuned in, and one of the things I had my first disagreement with the vice president-elect when he said, America, this is not who we are. Disagree strongly, because I think this is exactly who America is. And as I've said before, the two original birth defects of this country are the genocide to Native people and the enslavement of African people. And the way that that has sort of manifested itself in desperate treatment was on full display last Wednesday.
Hmm. Melanie Funchess, what did you see last Wednesday?
I saw white privilege on full display. I agree with Jerome. This is who we are. This is who we have been. And it feels like, you and I have had this conversation before about Big Bird and Mr. Snuffleupagus, and how black people in America have been Big Bird forever, saying Mr. Snuffleupagus is real. And now all of a sudden everybody sees it and they want us to be shocked. Hmm. You know, my thing is that what we have to understand is, they said, you know, people like, you know, aren't you shocked? I said, no. And at the same time, we know, like, when you see how these people came in, I would not be surprised if some of the Capitol Police were also part. And I'm going to say that. I don't care. That were also held those same views, because there is no way that they should have gotten into the people's house like that. And that's all I got to say about that.
Simeon Bannister, same question.
So, Evan, next week we're going to celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King. And it was King who said at Grosse Pointe High School, March 14th of 1968, in a speech that we shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. He said we shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to the earth will rise again. He goes on to say that we shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. And I think that what we've seen is another vindication of Dr. King's words. And certainly we've seen a reaping of what has been sown historically. But I take hope in this idea that no lie can live forever, and that truth is ultimately going to rise. And what I saw last week was maddening. It was angering. It was not terribly surprising, but I'm happy that we will overcome it working together with folks that share a common vision about how this country can and should be.
Matthew, what did you see?
Similar to our fellow guest, I was shock, outrage. You know, I think what it demonstrated is that the ideal of our democracy is the greatest threat to the ideology of white supremacy, and that for us to be the nation that we've been envisioned, there's a stain that has to be reconciled and dealt with in our nation.
Well, and Jerome, you know, I certainly take the point when you say you take issue with those who say this is not who we are. When you say, yes, this is who we are, this is who we have been, and we must confront it. I think there is a danger in, and I'm sure I've done this myself, I'm sure, in the last 5 days, of talking about what happened last Wednesday as if it's over, as if it was a one-off, as if it's done. In the immediate, you know, days ahead here, Jerome, what needs to happen next here to you know, whether it's Congress dealing with this, whether this is charges for people who participated, the kinds of public discourse and dialogue? I mean, are there sort of solution-oriented steps that must happen? Because we hear a lot about healing and not having division and being careful not to inflame. I guess I'm curious to know what you think that means, especially in the immediacy.
I think about it in a lot of ways, but certainly, you know, for this show, let's talk about local. You know, I think, Evan, you have a big platform, and all media does. I think it's important for us to know what do our elected officials feel about what happened. You know, the people who we sent to do jobs, particularly, as it turns out, our elected Republican officials, but certainly all elected officials. How do you feel, and how does that rest on us locally? As it's said so many times, all politics is local. We don't want to lose sight of the big picture, but we have these issues facing us right in front of us with respect to the disparate treatment, if you will. Just 6 months ago, a short time ago, we saw that right here in Rochester, where I know young people who are peacefully protesting who, you know, got beat up right now. So I think we have our own reckoning to do. What do we feel? What does Monroe County feel like given what happened on January 6th? Because it wasn't the first time, you know. And as Melanie said, you know, people of color have been sort of ringing this bell a long, long time ago. So, like, we've been trying to tell y'all, you know. Unfortunately or fortunately, you know, people are, quote-unquote, being bold with their hate and their racism. And we have to deal with that. We have to find, well, you know, where are these people? Are they in our schools? Are they in our churches? Well, they're everywhere. So I think it's on us to try to sort that out and try to keep people away from, particularly, I'm so, you know, focused on children and families, away from them. That could harm them. Socially, emotionally, physically, in every way. So I think about it from a local perspective, Evan, and because that really, really concerns me.
Okay, Melanie, what about you? In the days ahead here, I don't want to ask this question in sort of a really kind of rose-colored glasses way about healing and unity. I mean, seriously, what has to happen in the days to come here? So what happened last Wednesday doesn't sort of play out in different ways?
I think there's two different things I'm going to talk about them separately. One, there needs to be justice meted out, handed down in such a way that people understand if we're saying that this is not who we are. The way that justice is handed down to the people who committed the insurrection needs to go according to the depth of the offense. On the other side, I am going to talk about healing because you know that's what I talk about. we need to really have real conversations with our children, with our young people, and with ourselves, and work continuously on building up the protective factors. You've heard me say before that Dr. Carl Bell said risk factors are not predictive factors because of protective factors. And right now, we see these risk factors all around us, right? We see people being, you know, white supremacists being able to go with impunity. We see all these things. And we cannot mitigate we can't fix all those risk factors. But what we can do for our families, what we can do for the Black and Brown community is lift up our protective factors so that we can build resilience in our people so that we can make it through this. Like what Simeon said before, because a lie cannot stand forever. But if we build up the protective factors, we will be able to see this through and overcome.
Simeon Bannister, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd say that, when Daniel Prude was brutally murdered in the street, that was the crystallization of an event that marked white supremacy. And I would argue that moment, again, as a crystallization, really held up a whole lot of other moments that we saw white supremacy play out. I thought of my own father, who at 67 years old died far too young as a result, I think, in a lot of ways, of the accrual of white supremacy on his physical person. Last week was a crystallization of a whole bunch of acts. There are little mini insurrections, little mini acts of sedition that happen day after day after day in this country. Let's think about the folks that we've seen on some of the screenshots and captures over the last week, that we've seen doctors and dentists, lawmakers, police officers, folks that in their daily lives are committing these acts of treason by undermining their neighbors, by denying folks the access to opportunity, by espousing racist and hateful beliefs. And so the question to me is, how are we going to stop giving ground on the mundane, right? That then the grandiose and the macro, we certainly have said all the right rhetorical things, but every day, how do we stand up and combat this, you know, mean-spirited, hateful racist that economically deprives so many folks around our country and right here in our community? And I think that there is a coalition of folks that are forming to say enough is enough. And that's the group that I'm certainly looking forward to engaging with and continuing to work with, are the folks that are saying enough and are finding ways in the mundane every day to call it out and to name it in the spaces that we occupy.
And Matthew, what do you think?
I'm still troubled by the events of last week, and I think there has to be real consequences, both locally and within our nation. How we react to this event and what happens next are a crucial turning point in our country. If the perception is acts like these can continue and can happen with impunity, then we are in real trouble as a country. And we have to look at ourselves or individually, we have to look at our organizations, we have to look at our community and ask, how are we perpetuating this? And how are we going to disrupt and change? And how are we going to move forward as a country in which these acts aren't tolerated, they are harsh consequences, and that we learn from them and we do what's needed to be done to disrupt these conditions that have created an environment where that was okay for some people to do.
Our guests are talking about the upcoming event, ABC presenting the virtual signature conference series, Racism is a Public Health Crisis, Attacking the Two Pandemics. And the events are January 14th, 21st, 28th. WXXI is a media sponsor, you should know. Registration is required. There's an advanced registration fee, $40 per day, or a discounted bundle rate of $100 for all 3 days. And you can register abcinfo.org. Jerome Underwood, President and CEO of Action for a Better Community. What's the mission of this upcoming series?
Evan, that was a really good plug for the conference. The mission for the conference series is a furtherance of ABC's overall mission, and that is to counteract poverty in Monroe and Ontario counties. Typically, you know that, and the public knows, we typically have a signature luncheon in October, but like so many other organizations, we've had to pivot away from doing in-person events. So we sat and we thought about not only what could we do, but more importantly, what should we do given the events of 2020? And we decided not only that the event was going to be virtual, but we've really changed, you know, the content of the event to be one we would typically have going to give out some awards. We're going to defer that to later in the year. But mainly we're going to use this opportunity to, again, to attack the two pandemics, that of systemic and structural racism and the disparate impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, which are so interrelated. So we're going to offer a lot of professional development for people who are doctors and therapists, HR workers. But ultimately, what we want to do, and you said it earlier, we want to disrupt what racism is. The Urban League had their virtual conference back in October to interrupt racism. The Urban League is a very, very strong partner. We're brother-sister organizations, you know, so we're not doing this in a silo. We're kind of holding hands. You know, it was like, okay, when Urban League pushes, and they can, we're going to push. And we have other partner organizations who are going to continue putting pressure on the systems, as we said, that uphold and allow racism to continue. So that is our obligation. ABC, as you know, came through the birth canal of injustice, and that's in our DNA, so we're fulfilling our overall mission.
Who should attend these events coming up here, Jerome?
I say from 15 to 115. As a matter of fact, and I say 15, I'm talking about high school students. We are making it so that we're going to have a number of students from RCSD. I've talked to Dr. Leslie Myers-Smalls. We're giving them complimentary registrations. So for also at East High School and also at UPrep High School, because we think that young people, certainly high schoolers, have not only a lot to learn, but a lot to say about what they see as justice. So we're talking about from CEOs who run corporations, private, not-for-profit, municipal, attorneys, whoever. This affects everyone. So we hope to have a wide variety of people attend. Consumers, the people at ABC serves, and the people at the Greater Rochester Health Foundation serves, who, you know, I got to pause and say thank you to our sponsors who have really stepped up in a big way. You know, not only the Health Foundation, but KeyBank and also ESL. The both hospital systems, U of R, RRH, and some others, they've really stepped up to the plate to allow us to bring a really high quality event, which has a very diverse group of presenters. And what we want to do on the 28th, people, we want to walk away with, this is what I'm going to do. Either at my soccer team, my church, my baseball team, my corporation, the board that I sit on, everybody can take some kind of action that is anti-racist. And we have to get to the policies and the practices that allow racism to thrive. So in that way, we need to be disruptive.
This series happens on the next three Thursdays. So January 14th, that's this Thursday, the 21st, the 28th. And the first in the series of racism as a public health crisis, attacking the two pandemics, the first theme is establishing the why. Melanie Funchess, we talked a little bit about that earlier. I was going to say earlier this year. It's last year now. It is 2021. It sort of feels like an extension of 2020 so far. We'll see if that changes. But Melanie, we talked about why racism is a public health crisis in your mind. Let's talk a little bit about the why of it, which is the theme of the first event on Thursday. Why is it framed that way?
Racism is a public health crisis because racism affects all of the social determinants of health. because racism is a cause of low birth weight babies, poor infant mortality among Black women. It's a cause for premature death, years of potential life lost for Black and brown people. For when you control for all other things, when it comes down to being Black in America, is a health risk in and of itself. So all the ways that it's perpetuated for us, it's not just like in the doctor's office. When people hear public health, they think about it just, you know, when you go into your doctor's office. It's about inadequate housing, substandard housing, inadequate education, you know, inadequate employment and pay, not getting a living wage. It's about having to pay higher rates for interest on loans. It covers all these things that allow us to live, learn, and pursue the quote unquote American dream. And because of all of those things, it is a public health crisis because it affects us on the population level.
Simeon Bannister, can you elaborate on that idea, too, that Melanie, the point that she's making there, racism as a public health crisis? Because what we've seen, especially throughout the pandemic, you know, when we saw demonstrations in the street after the killing of George Floyd, we saw a lot of public health experts, epidemiologists saying that, yes, when you gather on the streets to protest, there is a risk of community spread of COVID, but there's also a risk to saying nothing regarding racism and its impact on our country. And there was, frankly, a lot of endorsement of those demonstrations. And some of the pushback, the critics were saying, you know, are you blending too far here? Public health, racism. And I take Melanie's points, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Simeon.
Well, I'd start by pointing out that, at least to my eye, there was a lot more mask wearing that was happening at some of the demonstrations.
Well, there certainly was.
In Minnesota and here in Rochester than I saw last week.
No question.
In D.C.
Absolutely.
But, so I think, I mean, this is the tension that, you know, people of color often find themselves in this country of ours, is that we are often stuck between bad options. We're stuck between whether we go out and fight for our right not to be shot or protect our right not to catch the pandemic and the coronavirus and the COVID-19. We're forced to fight between whether we send our kids to schools that are quote-unquote good schools that might be psychologically traumatic and damaging for our children, or we send them to schools that, while more diverse, may not provide them with an adequate education. So, like, these are the kinds of choices that people of color are confronted, and the aggregate of these choices ticks off those telomeres, knocks off years of life. And that's the example that I offer even in my own family. I mentioned my dad earlier. And so there is absolutely a need to address it, and we have to prioritize. And at this juncture, we say that if we don't declare racism a public health crisis, because long before COVID-19 showed up, we were already dealing with that. If we don't make that declaration and we don't actively take steps to do something about it, then we can assure you that it will continue unabated. And so our obligation at this point, you know, Dr. King risked his life, as did Malcolm X and so many others, in the fight for racial justice. And unfortunately, we're cast in the unfortunate position of having to do the same.
Matthew, do you want to add to that?
I would just add that, you know, if we're going to be serious about improving health and serious about improving the health and well-being of this community, we have to look at root causes. And if you track back the data and information, everything comes back to how racist practices, racism has created the systems and the environment that we're currently in, resulting in the outcomes that we see around us.
If you want to register for the upcoming series of events, or even just one off, there are three of them. If you want to attend on Thursday, Establishing the Why of Racism as a Public Health Crisis. That is Thursday. You can register abcinfo.org, abcinfo.org. Next Thursday, the 21st of January, the subject is health in the series of Racism as a Public Health Crisis. And the final event, Be the Healing, on January 28th. And I asked Jerome this. I'll ask our other guests. I mean, Matthew, who are you really, in your mind, thinking ought to be attending these virtual events and you know, what you're hoping to see this week?
My hope is that anyone who's able to and possible within the community is able to attend, because the information that's going to be shared, the lessons that will be available, the opportunity is to both introspective as individuals, but also as within your organization, leaders within our community. What can we do? How can we affect change? And find practical tools. And then the other piece is having the accountability and the action steps afterwards to where, if you know, committing to do work and those commitments then coming to life will improve the health and well-being of this community.
How do you feel about it, Simeon? Who do you want to see attend these events?
You know, Evan, I was thinking, again, framing the last week's events. We've heard so much about parlor or parlay. We've heard about some of the seedy underbelly of the Internet where all of this discussion was taking place. We get to have our conversation out in the open. We get to have our conversation in a place that all those that are interested in making this declaration and doing something about it can join us as a rejoinder to some of the unseemly things that are having. So come one, come all. I think the idea here is that we get a chance to unify and to make our declaration, and we get to do that together. With folks that are from different backgrounds and hues, folks that have decided to serve as allies, and folks that are the most affected and impacted, coming together to say enough, and we expect and will work for better.
Melanie Funches, who do you want to see attend?
I want to see everyone under the sound of my voice and their cousin, right? I believe that we all need to enter into this conversation. Because if this, you know, people may be saying, well, this doesn't affect me directly. You know, I'm not a person of color. I don't live in the city. You know, I may have be of another social economic strata. This, as a public health crisis, affects everyone. Because what we have to understand is that even though we've fostered this thing in this country of rugged individualism, we are interdependent. The people getting Social Security today count on the people who are working. But if we have 12 years of potential life loss, people are not able to earn money to put into the system to support you. If you need long-term care and people are having years of potential life loss, you don't have people to care for you. This is all of our issues. And like my co-panelists have said, we get to have this conversation out in the open. Because this is not just a black and brown problem. This is an American problem. This is a Rochester problem. This is all of our issue, and we need to come together to solve it.
Well, you heard earlier this hour Melanie Funches say that part of the path forward, particularly after the riot and insurrection of last Wednesday, involves actual accountability and a real effort to make sure that we don't just sort of try to wash our hands of what happened, pretend it can't happen again, pretend that's not who we are, and pretend that we would inflame things by prosecuting, arresting, holding people accountable. Well, here's news from NPR that just came down. The articles of impeachment have been officially filed by the House, and I'll just read a little bit more from NPR.org. With 9 days left before President Trump's term comes to an end, the House of Representatives is forging ahead with plans to try to remove the president from office over his role in his supporters' violent attack last week on the United States Capitol. A vote is expected this week, possibly coming on Wednesday, end quote. Now, we do know there are some Republicans in both chambers, the Senate and the House, who have said that they do want to see removal by any means necessary. So this won't be just a party line vote this week, but it will be interesting to see if there will be any more Republicans who come on board with Democrats, because there's been a lot of rhetoric back and forth about what happens there. But so now you're up to speed on that, and I'm sure NPR and WXXI will be covering that. After our only break of the hour, we're going to talk more about the upcoming series, the ABC virtual conference series, Racism as a Public Health Crisis, Attacking the Two Pandemics. And our guests helping us understand the mission of this series, Jerome Underwood is the president and CEO of Action for a Better Community and a member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group. Melanie Funches is a member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group and the Black Healers Network. Simeon Bannister, vice president of community programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation and a member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group. And Matthew Kuhlenbeck is president and CEO of the Greater Rochester Health Foundation. Let's take this only break, and we are right back with them. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on The Next Connections. If there are impeachment hearings and any developments there, WXXI and NPR will have that for you. And we will have a conversation on the program about impeachment with scholars and legal experts. about it as an option historically and what's on the table right now. That's coming up Tuesday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Rich writes to us to say, the problem with racism runs deep in this country. You can't blame black people for refusing the vaccine, and I'm sure he means the COVID vaccine, the coronavirus vaccine. But Rich says, but that would make the problem only worse. What a mess. That's from Rich. So there's a health issue in this community. Jerome Underwood, how do you see the point that Rich is making there, that certainly you can't blame black people for refusing the vaccine? We've talked about why in this program, about a history decades and decades long of medical abuse, of lies, deceit, frankly, of at times murder. I mean, people dying from withheld treatment in Tuskegee, as an example. So Rich is saying you can't blame people for having suspicion or fear or refusal. But if we see that refusal in big numbers, it's only going to make the divide worse in this country. And he concludes by saying, what a mess. What do you think, Jerome?
Well, on January 21st, that day is our, we're dubbing that day our health day. We're going to deal directly with the issue of the vaccine. Again, we're fighting the two pandemics. That day, our keynote speaker is just an amazing, amazing man. We all know him well. You know, Wade Norwood. And following Wade's keynote, which we know is going to be fiery and just a call to action in and of itself, we're putting together a panel of medical professionals to discuss the vaccine. You know, so again, certainly my role is not to tell anyone to take or not take the vaccine, but we have a moral obligation, certainly as ABC, to get people the information, the best information, so that they can make the best decision for their family. That's what's crucial. Without a doubt, we know the history, we know it well, and not just Tuskegee, but very recent history. Very, and that needs to be said. Now, notwithstanding, we have professional medical people who have been involved in clinical trials, who are trusted messengers of this community. So we're going to make them available at the ABC conference to discuss the vaccine. Who should, who shouldn't take it, when you should take it, how do you develop the kind of trust? Because counteracting racism, right, as we say in business, you know, excellence moves at the speed of trust, right? We have some trust issues that are very, very valid. And the caller, I'm sorry, the listener pointed that out. We have to deal with those things because, Melanie said, we have to heal, not only from COVID, but to the deep, deep, deep-seated trauma that as a result of racism. Again, racism is a public health crisis. So, but specifically to COVID, on Tuesday, I'm sorry, on the morning of the 21st, there's going to be an expert panel discussing the vaccine.
Yeah, let me ask your colleagues about that, and I'll just emphasize the point that CEO Underwood is making there. It's the second in the series on racism as a public health crisis. The subject is health, with an emphasis on the vaccine and the pandemic. That's two Thursdays from now, 10 days from now, January 21st. Register in advance, abcinfo.org. And this is not just aimed at CEOs, community leaders, executives. This is for everybody. Simeon Bannister, how are we doing on the issues that Rich raises in his email?
I will confess that right now I'm terrified. And the reason why I'm terrified is that, at least in some of the conversations that I've been in, where at least we've made some headway and the word equity is being used, I still hear some of the same old approaches. And there are a lot of reasons why those approaches have historically proven inadequate and will prove inadequate now. For example, what I hear from a lot of folks in the conversations I'm in is, we've just got to go and talk to the faith community. And the faith community is absolutely essential, no doubt about it. But we also know that 42,000 of our neighbors in the city are young folks between the ages of 20 and 35. And those young folks, guess what they're not doing is going to church. Some are, of course, but many of them are not. And so the question then is, how do we reach a group that's been, you know, terribly disaffected, and that we often, even before the pandemic, had difficulty connecting with? And so what I wonder is how we are going to leverage the same kind of innovation that we use to sell people things they don't need. How are we going to use that kind of innovation, the stuff that gets apps on your phone, the stuff that chases you around the internet when you make a search and you can't get away from it because it keeps popping up in every window? How are we going to use that kind of technology to make sure that we get these needs in front of our young folks? How are we going to leverage social media, et cetera, to get the word out to different audiences in different ways? And are we prepared to make the expenditure to make that happen? That's what I'm going to be keeping an eye on.
And you're sort of a data person, Simeon. I mean, what is a metric of success in your mind on this? How do you measure if this is working?
Well, this is one is a pretty straightforward one. Who's getting the vaccine and are they taking it? I mean, this one is there are a lot of things in this field that are measurement resistant. This is not one of them. We'll be able to see, I think, pretty clearly how the distribution is happening. What we do need, though, is transparency around the data. We had to fight a little too hard to learn about differentiation in race with respect to how the virus was traveling through the communities. We had to fight a little too hard mm-hmm. to get that information. That should be stock and trade at this point. And so my hope is that as we move into this phase of vaccine distribution, that automatically we know that we need to collect data in that way and to be able to present that data and that information so that we can then target our efforts and our resources. And ultimately, the other metric I'm going to look out for, again, is how the dollars are being spent.
All right. Melanie Funchess, how do you feel about the themes of Rich's email?
Like Simeon, I am terrified because for me, it's not just the fact that we're going to the wrong places and that we're using outdated methods that didn't work when they were supposed to be in vogue. It's also around how I'm hearing mainstream messaging discounting the mistrust, right? I was on a call last week and people were talking about we need to get past the myths in the Black community. We need to get past the myths. And by the time they got to me, I said, no, these are not myths. These things happened. It's true. And it's not just Tuskegee, right? And because we have got to change out how we're looking at this, we need to change, and we need to change all the aspects of this. And what people need to walk up to is saying, not saying that people have myths. Stop putting it on the folks who are not taking the vaccine, but put it on the systems where it belongs and say, we did y'all wrong. We have been doing you wrong. And also, like what Simeon said, how are the dollars going to flow into our communities, you know, around getting this message out about make sure our people get the vaccine, make sure that all the things that need to happen, happen. Because right now, I don't see it. Because like Simeon said, when this first came, even though we knew that this would be it'd be a disparity, people were looking at that they couldn't collect the data by race. So if we don't do it this way on the front end, how are you going to do it this way on the back end? Mm-hmm. There's no trust.
Yeah, boy. Matthew Kuhlenbeck, you want to add to that? Go ahead.
I mean, I think there's. I just want to echo both Simeon and Melanie's comments. We have a significant challenge ahead of us. If we look at even what federal resources have been made available, they're through the traditional systems of covering and looking through payers and reimbursement. How we do this work in our community is going to be incredibly difficult and something that we're going to have to try new avenues, try new approaches, because if we just rely on the same systems that we've relied on, we're going to get the same results that we've received.
All right. Well, I want to turn to another listener comment here, and this is from Stephen, who says, wouldn't the public health question be better addressed from the bottom to the top? What happened to George Floyd? Murder? Yes. Wrongful death? Yes. What happened to society there? Racial subjugation. Subjugation should be codified in statute and made punishable by federal law. There is nothing that can be done to address the ill it causes at the individual, municipal, or state level. That's from Stephen. I mean, I'll start with Simeon on this one. I mean, I think what Stephen seems to be saying, there's nothing that can be done to address the ill it causes, racism, racial subjugation, at the individual, municipal, or state level. It should be codified in federal law. He's talking about accountability this week and otherwise. But, I mean, do you agree with that framing of it, Simeon?
Yeah, I'm trying to kind of track his point. I think that there's certainly the case that, you know, racism operates on a number of different levels, and many of us have been attempting to diagnose that with more acuity. Certainly, there's some efforts in the community underway in that regard. I know the RAISE Commission has continued some of its work, and there are other entities to try to identify some of the policy questions that are at play. And I agree that that is, you know, an essential dimension. The one thing I will say, though, is that, at least in my, you know, study of how racism has operated, in some ways, there's an old allegory that the founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, was a deist, and he believed in this allegory of the watchmaker. And basically, in that allegory, the watchmaker kind of winds this watch and then steps back. Watchmaker's God, in this case, steps back and allows it to play itself out through time. And it doesn't have to intervene because the watch has already been wound. I look at history and I say, man, we had some real watch winding moments with, for example, redlining, some watch winding moments with some of the policy decisions. And then you can step back and the same disparities continue to play themselves out without any real intervention. That's why you have to be anti-racist in policy and not just not racist, right? That's why we've got to go even further. And I'm hoping that that's what we start to see coming out of some of the activity here municipally, locally, as well as ideally on a federal level.
Yeah, and Melanie, I think I'm trying to be charitable to Stephen's email because I agree with Simeon. I'm not sure I'm fully tracking the point other than he seems to be saying he wants accountability on the federal level, that it's impossible sort of to wipe out the ills of this on the local level. And it seems to me, I mean, if you want to argue that healing and, you know, unity isn't possible unless you hold, for example, the rioters last week accountable and you actually prosecute and you take a look at who enabled and you prosecute and you make sure that you are proving that you live your values and you're trying to set examples. I take that point. But I don't know that you can say, Melanie, that that's the only way that you're going to cure some of these ills. I mean, I think that that would probably leave a lot of doors unopened. What do you think, Melanie?
What I believe is that we do not need to be dichotomous in our thinking. It's not this or that. It's not federal law or accountability, or it's this and that and that and that and that. It is holding people accountable. It is trying to undo the wrongs of redlining. It is investing money. It is reparations. It is any number of things that will take place on the local, state, and federal level simultaneously that will get it there, right? It's not, you know, we can't, when I heard this, I'm like, you know, it's like passing the buck. Well, I can't do anything on this level. It needs to go from these folk up here. No, everybody has a role. Pick up your stuff and do your job, do your work. Because we all have a role to do this because we've all people have either done it or they perpetuated it. And it's not about your intent, it's about your impact.
And did I hear Jerome jump in? Go ahead, Jerome.
Yeah, you know, the person who sent the note, you know, like Mel said, I got to just repeat what she said because it's so important. It's not this or that. It's all of it. So going back to your earlier question, who is this conference for? It's for everybody. Let me give an example. You know, I'm also the co-chair of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. RMAPI, you know, same mission, fight poverty. RMAPI has an employer pledge. There's lots of employers in Monroe County, you know. So when we look at, pick a data point of employment, right, and how the disparities in unemployment, let's put it that way, you know, and we know who leads the pack in employment. Once again, black and brown people, you know, like Dr. DeGruy says, the poison is in the cookies. So what do we do about that? And here's where policy comes in. Stay with me for about a minute with this example. We know that you should not, there's a federal law that says you cannot discriminate, it's against the law, discriminate race, age, color, creed, etc. However, we know that black and brown people are unemployed at a rate maybe two, almost three times that of our Caucasian brothers and sisters. So if we're going to hire people, we should discriminate. But that will be against the law, so we should change the law. You know what I mean? So people say, well, wait a minute, what are you talking about? That's, you get the counter argument, that's reverse discrimination. But that's what did it in the first place. That's what redlining was. It was discriminatory. You know, so back to the Simmons analogy of the watch winding moment, we need a new watch. You know, and that's what policy can do. We have to rectify the harm and the injustice that was done, not at the expense of somebody else, but because justice, you know, is the only thing that's going to get us to equity. You cannot have equity without justice. And Melanie mentioned the word reparations. The reparations comes in so many forms, but it's necessary. Because if I take your phone, Evan, I just take it. And then a week later, you know, I come by and I say, Evan, I'm sorry. Are we good? Of course not. I got to give the phone back. At a minimum, I got to give the phone back. Then there's the psychological damage that I did to you because now you can't live without your phone and you're missing your appointments. You see what I mean? So it's everywhere. Everywhere we go. If you run an organization, you're on the board, what does your board look like? Do you have any policies and procedures that is going to lead you to be an anti-racist organization? How do you evaluate your CEO? Are you giving him or her a direct charge to say, look, your staff must be diverse and must closely mimic the community that you serve? Things like that, you know? Or if you were the janitor, you know, not disparaging janitors, but, you know, like, hey, does our organization support the declaration that racism is a public health crisis? Let me knock on the HR door and find out. Well, why don't we? What can we? Everybody can do something.
Why, Jerome, is this the first time I've heard the analogy of the stolen phone? That is that is really something.
That
will stay with me, and I will try to remember to credit you if I bring it up in conversation in the future. I want to squeeze in a phone call from Nick and Webster, who wants to jump in. Go ahead, Nick.
Hey, I'm hearing, you know, debate about racism and my own debate about my participation in and what it is, but it's often called systemic. And racism is systemic, and its first cousin, poverty, is called systemic. And what makes it systemic is that it's the cause and effect are one and the same. The cause of racism and the effect of racism are the same. That's what makes it systemic. The same with poverty. And when you see that it's a self-fulfilling situation, that's the systemic part of it. Not that there are so many people, it's such a broad thing that it's systemic. But if you can break that cycle of its cause and effect, then you have a chance of changing racism. But without that, its cause and effect are the same thing. That's a problem. And I think that's really significant to understand that.
Mm. Nick, thank you for the phone call. I appreciate that. And I've got time for our guests to jump in, maybe 30 seconds apiece on that, and then we'll make sure everyone's caught up to date on how they can register if they want to be part of the Racism as a Public Health Crisis conference series coming up here. Jerome, what do you make of Nick's point there?
Race is not real. Racism is real. Racism is an ideology that's deeply embedded in the thought and the psyche of this country and, well, across the world as well. That's what we have to get at. The actual thought that there, you know, some race of people is superior to another just based on appearance, that is deep-seated, and it leads to racist socialization, meaning action. That's what we have to get at. It's a thought process, you know, so being anti-racist and people into that is very, very important because we cannot just be observers of this if we want it to change. You know, so whoever the caller is, I would encourage him, well, wherever you belong, what does that look like? Can you disrupt the racism inside there? Because no institution in this country is void of racism.
Melanie Funches, go ahead. Mel, are you there? Just make sure you're on mute.
Yes, I'm here.
You got it.
My thought on what he said was that is in alignment with Jerome's. It's like racism is baked into the cookies of America, right? Racism is in the DNA. Just like we have intergenerational transmission of trauma, there is intergenerational transmission of racism. And racist white supremacy and racist ideology. And that is what we need to get at, because that is in the minds and the hearts of the people who perpetuate and create and make sure the systems keep going.
Simeon Bannister, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd love to sit with your caller and kind of explore exactly what he means by kind of cause and effect. But I'm going to take it that racism is a self-perpetuating system, and that's mm-hmm. certainly been the case, and it's why it's important to intervene with anti-racism. The other point I just want to make quickly, Evan, is that I want us to think about what we've lost over the last few years, what we've lost in terms of our standing in the world, what we've lost in terms of environmental degradation, what we've lost in terms of our own economic strength. And all of those losses have at their root racism, right? That we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for racism. And what I want folks to start to appreciate mm-hmm. is that being anti-racist isn't just, it's not, racism is a public health crisis, for black people. Racism is a public health crisis for everybody. Yes, all sir. Of us lose. All of us are being undermined. All of us are being hurt. And all of us have a vested interest in doing something about it. Because if we can root out that racism and remove this stain, we free ourselves up to pursue an agenda for economic growth. We open up the channels for environmental sustainability that have plagued us. Because in each of those areas, every single one of them, to the person, when I name them, you can see the racial disparities, whether it's in environment, economics, et cetera.
That's got to be the last word, and a powerful one there. And we'll let our listeners know the event is Racism as a Public Health Crisis, Attacking the Two Pandemics. Experts, conversation, and all kinds of resources starting Thursday, January 14th. That's this Thursday, the next Thursday, and the following. All the information, abcinfo.org, abcinfo.org. Jerome Underwood, thanks for the time. Good luck with this, and I know we'll talk soon.
Thank you, Evan.
Melanie Funches, always a pleasure and an honor to have you. Thank you, Melanie.
Thank you.
Simeon Bannister, thanks for the knowledge as always. Thank you, sir.
Good to be with you.
Matthew Killenbeck, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks to Megan Mack, producer, Rob Braden, engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.